On this week's 51%, there's an effort to make the morning after pill more widely available in one city. Find out how female farmers are faring in New York.
I had a lot of women farmer role models growing up.
And hear stories of love and karma. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. In recent months, many Midwestern states have passed laws restricting access to abortion. Reproductive rights groups are challenging those laws, but also working to help prevent pregnancies. Lisa Gillespie with Side Effects Public Media reports on one effort in Louisville, Kentucky, to make emergency contraception pills widely available.
So we are at the corner of Goss and Texas in Germantown in Louisville, outside a Bean coffee shop.
I'm standing with Meg Sass-Stern, the support fund director for the Kentucky Health Justice Network. We go into the coffee shop, and then she takes me into the bathroom. 8 pink and silver plastic packages with emergency contraception across the front are sitting on the counter.
So as you can see, there's just a few doses here for the taking. And this is kind of how we leave them. I've left them in some locker rooms and tables in different public places.
The medication, it's an emergency contraceptive called Preventiza from the company that also makes Vagisil. It was on the market for less than a year and didn't do well. So $2 million worth of the pills are being sent to advocacy groups in Kentucky, Indiana, and other states. Kentucky's only abortion clinic is in Louisville, which creates problems for women who live hours away. That's why preventing unplanned pregnancies is even more pressing for reproductive rights groups. And in rural areas like eastern Kentucky, getting contraception can be especially tricky, Stern says.
But it does make me think about that person who is in, you know, Whitley County and might need a dose of the morning after pill and is afraid to go to their one pharmacy in town and ask for it because the pharmacist is their neighbor.
For many, the price can also be a barrier. Emergency contraception costs about $50 a dose. But Alina Salgonikov at the Kaiser Family Foundation says there's a big difference between a pill that induces an abortion and what the emergency contraceptive pill does. Reached at her home, she said,
emergency contraceptives will never disrupt an established pregnancy, whereas an abortion pill is an abortifacient and will.
Preventiza and similar products like Plan B stop an egg from releasing from an ovary, preventing fertilization. These pills work about 90% of the time, but aren't as effective for women who are considered overweight. These sorts of drugs are becoming more popular.
So we've been tracking it since 2002, where 4% of women reported ever using emergency contraceptive pills.
About 22% of women had used the pills, according to the most recent survey, which ended in 2015. Salgonikov says contraception can help women plan a pregnancy when they're ready.
The evidence is that, you know, when women are able to plan their pregnancies, it has better outcomes for their own health as well as the infant's health.
Some religious groups see birth control as immoral. That includes the Archdiocese of Louisville. Pro-life coordinator Ed Harpring says the Archdiocese opposes emergency contraception.
A woman is taking that step, so to speak, interrupting a natural cycle, if you will, and that's where we would have a problem with it, just like we would have a problem with contraceptive pills or the birth control pills.
But many women see it as a personal health issue, and the Health Justice Network's Preventiza campaign came in handy for one woman during Kentucky Derby weekend. Brandon Pearson, a rideshare driver, picked up a woman around 1 a.m. His passenger said,
do you know of any pharmacies that are open 24 hours? And she basically shared too much information and lucked out with the right driver that was able to help them. I got to play emergency contraceptive fairy and help somebody out when they needed it.
Stern says they're still distributing about 4,000 doses at health fairs, festivals, and community centers. I'm Lisa Gillespie in Louisville.
The Census of Agriculture is a complete count of U.S. farms and ranches and the people who operate them. Even small plots of land, whether rural or urban, growing fruit, vegetables, or raising livestock count. If $1,000 or more of such products were raised and sold, or normally would have been sold, during the census year. The Census of Agriculture, taken once every 5 years, looks at land use and ownership, operator characteristics, production practices, income, and expenditures. The latest one, for 2017, came out this year, and 51%'s Dave Lucas gives us a snapshot, digging into the capital region of New York with a focus on female farmers.
The number of female farmers is on the rise across New York. A Center for Economic Growth analysis of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's newly released 2017 Census of Agriculture finds a 24% increase in women farmers in the Capital Region between 2012 and 2017. Marge Randles runs a cheese manufacturing operation in Glens Falls and a dairy farm in Argyle. She's noticed more women farmers and points out some facts that she feels are influencing the perception of women in agriculture.
The number of dairy farms has decreased significantly in New York State because of the economics. And I think there's less dairy farmers, mostly of them are male, but there's less of those, so the percentage of women increases because there's less of the dairy farmers. Small farms have been bought out by large farms. Henceforth, there might be one farm, but he might own what was four different farms. I presume you consider me a woman in agriculture. In reality, I'm a cheesemaker and own a cheese and yogurt processing business, my husband. And legally, according to IRS, we are not a farm. We're a manufacturing plant. So sometimes those lines of what's a woman in agriculture sort of seem a little fuzzy to me.
According to CEG, as of 2017, the 8-county region had 3,405 farms, and women farmers worked at 2,225, or 65% of them. Region-wide, there were 2,433 women farmers, or 40% of the 6,055 total farmers. Only the Hudson Valley had a higher concentration at 42%. At 678, Washington County was number 4 of the state's 62 counties. Eliza Pickering, originally from Vermont, now calls the Pitney Meadows Community Farms in Saratoga Springs, where she is the vegetable manager, home.
I had a lot of women farmer role models growing up. And there's a really strong network of farms in Vermont doing really neat things. I guess I've never seen it quite just as a man's role.
For Pickering, it was a rocky road to farming.
In college, I felt very kind of confused with a lot of things. And I guess I didn't really find my place. And I just felt like, I don't know, coming back to the land made sense. There's just a lot of things in the world that didn't make sense. But what did make sense was doing something with purpose and meaning and growing community through food could be an outlet for that. And I was lucky enough to have family background with those resources. And so I then pursued that as an option.
Pickering loves the long days and the many facets of farm work.
I like to get to the farm before everybody else and kind of get organized before they trickle in. And right now it's harvesting a lot of lettuce in the morning before 9:30. You've got to have those greens harvested, and then it's washing lettuce, getting it out to the restaurants, and then shifting gears and getting into the field and getting a lot of field maintenance done out there. You know, the crew usually leaves around 4 or 5, and I like to stay after and finish some things that didn't get done, and then I head home.
Diane Allen co-owns Lavender Farm, growing lavender in Whitehall near Lake George.
We have 80 acres of land. The front 10 are what we have open to the public, and we have thousands of lavender plants, 30 different varieties, predominantly English lavender because it is much more winter hardy for our climate.
Allen characterizes lavender as the jackknife of all herbs. Products sold on Allen's farm, considered an agrotourism attraction, include bath salts, soaps, candles, teas, jellies, and honey. Allen urges any girl or woman thinking of adapting a farm lifestyle,
if it's your passion, then go for it. It is a lot of hard work. You know, it's one of those, as with any small business, the first 24 hours of the day go to the business, and any time after that is all yours. It's a lot of hard work, but when you see how happy people are, it really makes it worthwhile. Pursue it. particularly for women owning a business, and farming is a business. Make sure you're farming outside the box, so to speak. Grow wrong color fruits and vegetables. Orange carrots are commodity. Purple carrots are a novelty. Harvest them when they're tiny. Drive down to the city with them and sell them to high-end chefs. That's how you're going to make money. You have to be creative.
The 2017 Census of Agriculture also shows New York's average annual net farm income of $42,875 per farm is slightly below the national average. For 51%, I'm Dave Lucas.
Dr. Sharon Ufberg returns with her 51% segment, Force of Nature. But this time, her force of nature brings her to the middle of the ocean on a journey that inspired her essay, Discovering Love at Any Age.
I had no expectation what I might experience during my time at sea. I just always dreamt of doing a transatlantic crossing alone, and the time had finally come. Maybe it was those old movie scenes of the elegant, bejeweled women with white gloves up to their armpits, standing alongside a dashing man in tails out on a polished deck that had always intrigued me. More likely, it was the complete joy I felt being out on the ocean that compelled me to join a 15-day sail across the Atlantic from Barbados to Lisbon. No stops, no ports of call. I relished the idea of being surrounded by nothing but the big blue sea. I set sail on the Windstar, a small four-mast sail-assisted ship with 75 strangers, about half the capacity of passengers the ship can carry. Plenty of room to just be. And the fact the captain of this specific sail was Belinda Bennett, the only female woman of color ship captain on the sea, made me feel just that much more certain I was on the right trip. What you may find on any journey is always an unknown, and despite all my comings and goings, it's still one of my favorite aspects of traveling. What I witnessed on this journey was no less inspiring. So what was it? It was pure and simple. It was true love. Love found late in life, love revisited, and a lot of constant, long-standing, committed love renewed again and again. Many of the guests and staff on board had been doing this trip together for years. Stepping onto the ship allowed everyone an opportunity to relax and suspend real life for a little while. I had no trouble doing just that. This mixed gang of traveling sailors showed up each year to celebrate another milestone in a life long lived. They were predominantly older, with extra time and a desire to just be one with the sea. They had no agenda other than making another sail across the Atlantic. I fell in love with them all. It was Jean and Mike, both in their 80s, back together after 55 years apart, four or five marriages later and several countries between them, sitting on the deck holding hands or sunbathing together, smiling, whispering, giggling, taking great care of one another's needs. It was Samuel, who shared the crossing with his wife of over 40 years. Five children and 19 grandchildren later, he never left the side of his partner, who was now slightly confused and unsure of herself, while he still remained sharp and robust. I have never seen such unconditional love and patience alongside such great happiness just being together. It was Larry, a widower who was up early each morning writing a book about his recovery after a stroke. He was sharing the trip with a newer love, Janet, who had been a dear friend of his late wife. I watched them laugh often, enjoying every day together. It was Walter, who sat at a table of six one evening and expressed profound love for his new girlfriend with tears of joy streaming down his face. They had met 3 years before on this very same trip. At 85 and 75, they had both already lived through prior romances and great loss, yet were able to feel love again. His claim is that this love is the greatest one of all. Witnessing some of the most vulnerable, open-hearted expressions of love took my breath away. One seafaring couple in their 70s rekindled a college connection and got married on the ship 5 years before. They soaked up the sun each day playing board games and puzzles together. another energetic couple in their 60s walked and did yoga together each morning. They were thoughtfully trying to navigate the tricky transition of how to retire and still find meaning and purpose in their next chapter. And then there was 91-year-old Ken, traveling with his 7th wife, Marcy. Ken was still snarky, funny, and very smart. He was a formidable trivia and Scrabble opponent and held his own at the bridge table. He judged the bartender competition and was more erudite than either of the other judges. Marcy took care of every need in the most lighthearted, loving way. I saw the great respect she gave to his independent nature while keeping a close watch on him. I was surrounded by people celebrating 50-plus year wedding anniversaries, 80th birthdays, and brand new love. I never heard a cross word between anyone, not one. I saw true love in every form, a gentle arm to lean on, a hug, a look, a smile. I felt the love that comes from the wisdom of age and survival, the love that appreciates the fragility of our time and celebrates each day together. This love changed me. It made me more mindful and more hopeful. This love made me feel more expansive about our ability to love at any age, despite great losses. It seems the capacity for love does not diminish with experience, but grows exponentially. This sale filled me with insight and a new, much appreciated perspective. While I was surrounded by all this love, I never felt alone or lonely. There were many other men and women who were single or chose to travel without their partners on this sale, just as I had. It never felt awkward to be on my own, and people were friendly and inclusive whether they were with a partner or a group of friends. Someone said this trip attracts a self-selected group of couples that already get along well and want to be together without a lot of distractions for days on end. That's probably true. How lucky for those of us that were able to experience it with them. This is Dr. Sharon Upberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
Dr. Sharon Upberg is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in California. With love at sea, why not love in America? South Dakota storytellers and motorcycle adventurers Scott and Tony Burns share their travel tale, Karma Margo, about how love is often a story of going through hell to get to heaven. Wait, those are song lyrics, right? Or as Love in America discovers at the Goshen Diner in the Hudson Valley region of New York, going through abuse, hunger, and pain in Russia to bringing kindness and pancakes to those traveling life's highways through parts of New York.
Karma Margo, a tale from the heart of America. Hanging with the Buddhists at the Karma Triana Dharma Chakra Tibetan Buddhist Monastery in Woodstock, New York, made me feel the need to come clean, a confession of sorts. I know that's really generally the realm of the Catholics, but the Noble Eightfold Path speaks to right mind and right action. So, here goes. My passion is our business, Love in America. And although I am a complete extrovert and relish the opportunity to accost total strangers in unlikely situations to talk about love, I enjoy how we travel across the country. I love to ride. We've said it before and it must be stated again. The only way to travel this amazing country of ours is on Blue Line highways and back roads, preferably on a motorcycle. It is along these routes that the heart of America is found, in all its beauty, glory, and gritty reality. A young Vietnamese cashier at a gas station, regretfully explaining that they do not have a public restroom, but that the Dunkin' Donuts a block down the road did, then offering up a free cup of coffee in apology. The coffee looked on the worst side of sludge, but I appreciated the Dunkin' Donuts tip. The 70-something African-American man who chatted us up at a barbecue restaurant in inner-city Detroit. A conversation starting with our license plates, expanding to his adventures riding an old shovel head across country as a young man, and ending with his expressing appreciation for what we do and what we ride. Margot, our hostess at the Goshen Plaza Diner in Goshen, go figure, New York, who shared snippets of her story between teasing Scott and seating customers. Walking into the diner, we were tired, disheveled, hot, sweaty, and I was cranky from lack of sleep. Thanks to a demonically possessed air conditioner in the previous night's motel room. So despite the beauty of the road and the landscape, my mood did not match the splendor and bliss we had traveled. I don't know what crossed Margot's mind when the scooter trash entered her diner. Whatever it was, this 50-ish, compactly curvy bundle of energy swept us into the blessedly cool interior and greeted us as long-lost friends. Thick, chocolatey hair topped her beautiful, open face. Constantly in motion, she never seemed flustered or anxious. Every movement held purpose, vivaciously serene. When we asked if we could have a particular booth where we could keep an eye on our bikes, she patted Scott's arm and said, "It's all right. It's safe around here." Scott and I laughed and explained that her comment seems to be the mantra from Ticonderoga and through Vermont, Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, and now Goshen, New York. After steering us to the only empty booth, a long line of seats away from the window through which our bikes were visible, she grabbed Scott's forearm and declared to me, "My goodness, isn't he handsome?" I heartily agreed as we settled in for a late breakfast. During our meal, Margot popped by to share her desert dry wit, complemented by her sunny, sunshine smile. "You can see the tops of your bikes from here," which we could. "You've got to try the gluten-free pancakes," which were delicious. And grabbing our waitress's arm, bent down next to our table to tell her, "I want you to look at this couple and see how beautiful they are." To us, she said, "I mean it. People only hear bad things. They need to hear good things. Tell them when they are beautiful." And all said with a spicy New York accent, tinted with a subtle Russian cant. Of course, with a comment like that, we paused her hurried scurry between seating folks, cashing others out at the register, greeting locals with hugs and strangers with smiles, to tell her about love in America. Our waitress leaned in to listen and then declared loudly, "Margot, you've got to tell them your story. Hers is one about going through hell to get to heaven." Just as we have found many love stories are. Margot rushed away to hug a local and cash another out with sincere and heartfelt calls of, "You have a great day." As we paid our bill, we tried to entice Margot to give us an interview. Unfortunately, she did not get off until 3 p.m., and we had just finished our meal at 10:30 a.m. Her boss was in the back and, according to Margot, would have a seizure if he saw me being interviewed instead of working. She did agree to covertly answer a question while she rang us up. Though not one of our standard questions, it fit. "Why are you so nice to everyone?" Her answer echoed an insight given to us by Grace, both a teacher in high school mathematics and a student of Buddhism, and our impromptu guide at the monastery. Grace shared with us her story of faith, loss, and learning to understand devotion. She explained her view of Dharma as wanting to help others to not suffer. A piece of her favorite prayer is, "May I become a boat, a raft, or bridge for all who wish to cross the water." In preface to her answer, Margot also shared snippets of her life between darting about the restaurant performing her myriad of duties. She is originally from Russia and was forced into a prearranged marriage. She has faced many, many struggles in her lifetime. It turns out that the twinkle in her eye I originally took for mischief is a composite of impishness, selflessness, and unshed tears. In her words, "I've experienced hunger. I've experienced abuse." She pauses, memories overwhelming her. "I was forced to marry someone I didn't want to marry, and I am crying because I want to be kind to people. I see beauty in people. I see kindness in people." Margot's love grew from pain and wanting to ease whatever suffering, whatever pain the people she encounters might be experiencing. She reminds them that they are beautiful and worthwhile. Margot is a boat, a raft, a bridge. Does she know she's a great Buddhist?
For more from Love in America's Scott and Tony Burns, go to loveinamerica.us.
This is Bird Note. A peacock's tail is magnificent. 4 or sometimes even 5 feet in length, when opened, it's an iridescent wonder, shimmering and covered in giant spots. And as it turns out, when it comes to that wonderful tail, there's even more than meets the eye. As this male Indian peafowl quivers his outstretched tail, it creates a rustling sound, almost like a drum roll. Scientists call this the peacock's train rattle. You might also call it the sound of peacock love. That train rattle is also causing a vibration in the air that we humans can't feel. But female peacocks, or peahens, can. That low-frequency rumble hits the sweet spot, also known as the resonant frequency of both the male's and female's crest feathers. They start to vibrate in unison. Peafowl also do a special wing shake, which seems to hit that same sweet spot. Scientists aren't quite sure how the train rattle love buzz fits into peacock mating behavior, but for the first time, we're starting to listen in. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1567.